You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickard are off today. Coming up, swearing can express anger, surprise, and a whole range of other emotions. We find out what makes swear words so much more powerful than others. First, as the national conventions get closer and state government races shape up, our next guest says Brown County will be Wisconsin's number one political battleground. Both state parties held their conventions in that area recently. A high number of independent voters live there, and an open race for the 8th District in the U.S. House of Representatives all make Brown County an important focal point for both parties. Adam Rodewald joins us now. He's a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Green Bay. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So why is Brown County specifically such a major battleground this time around?
Yeah, I think you covered a lot of it in your introduction, but there's really a couple things all happening all at once. First, and probably the biggest, is we have an area here that where there's really a lot of independent and undecided voters, which makes it really important for candidates. I think if you look around elsewhere in the state, you kind of know where people stand politically in general in the Milwaukee area, in Madison, which are heavily Democratic. You know that belt of counties around Milwaukee that is heavily Republican. You look at northeast Wisconsin, and suddenly it's a little less predictable. And the political parties know that, and they see opportunity there. At the same time, you add in factors like a major media market with a pretty wide geographic footprint located in Green Bay, and then the 8th Congressional District, which has an open seat with Reid Ribble not seeking re-election, and Democrats see huge opportunity there, and Republicans are not going to give that seat up without a fight. So it's really one of the most important seats on a national level, which is bringing a whole lot of attention to this area as well, not to mention money and resources.
So as you said, about a third of the county's voters register as independents, but how does that usually play out when it comes to voting on actual issues and candidates? Do those independents tend to go one way or the other?
Yeah, so the data that I've referred to in my reporting comes from a survey that UW Oshkosh did. It was just a couple years ago now, but they found 36% of voters in northeast Wisconsin identify with no major party, meaning they're independent or undecided. If you break that down, about two-thirds of them tend to align with one particular party or the other, Democrat or Republican, but that still leaves around 12% who don't lean one way or the other. They're kind of the sweet zone of people who are persuadable, and so that's a pretty big number of people that the parties can go after and try and help them win an election.
So as we mentioned, both the state Democratic and Republican parties had their conventions in Brown County this year. First of all, is that unusual for both of the parties to meet in the same city?
Admittedly, I don't have a lot of history there, so I can't say whether or not it's happened before. Certainly in talking to people and the reporting I've done, that was noteworthy. Mm-hmm. And something that they thought spoke to the importance of this part of the state.
And do you think that it did have an impact on the voters? Did Brown County voters feel particularly noticed by one party or the other, or maybe by both?
Yes, you know, especially the people who are politically involved or maybe belong to the county Republicans or county Democrats. They were very energized and excited about having all of this attention. So I think that for the communities, it's really getting people talking and energized, and of course that's going to, I would predict, spill out to other people who may not have been engaged. They're going to notice that energy and potentially kind of see it expand and snowball around.
We're talking with reporter Adam Rodewald right now. He's a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Green Bay. And we're talking about what a political battleground Brown County is this time around. And Adam, you know, Donald Trump is obviously a big figure in this election and for both Republicans and Democrats. The state of Wisconsin went for Ted Cruz. So where are you seeing Brown County voters lining up in the presidential race?
I think that they are uncertain from the people I've talked to. You know, when the convention was in town, I spent a lot of time there talking to people, and Donald Trump really was an afterthought at that convention, and people were trying to really focus and unify around other candidates. I think the strongest message was, there's more going on in this election besides the presidential race, and we don't want people to forget about those other candidates who are down ticket from the president. And I think that there is some concern there that if people aren't comfortable with Donald Trump, they may tune out and overlook those other candidates. And so that's really where a lot of the energy and focus has been. Now that could change, of course, moving forward, but currently that's where I see the feelings being at.
And as we wrap up, Adam, talking about those down-ticket races and the presidential race as well, what are the biggest issues, do you think, that are in the minds of Brown County voters that may lead them in one direction or another?
You know, it's the same issues that you're seeing everywhere. People are concerned about safety, about the economy, about jobs and equality. So, you know, all those things are going to be really important here, just as they are just about everywhere else.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks.
That was reporter Adam Rodewald talking about why Brown County is shaping up as one of Wisconsin's biggest political battlegrounds. You can check out his article about that over on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, coming up, swearing has been around for centuries, if not longer. We'll look at what gives swear words their power. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, the latest Kids Count data book came out today. We'll find out how the well-being of Wisconsin's children measures up to how kids are doing in other states. First, swear words are some of the most powerful words in a language. While some ideas expressed through swear words are consistent from one culture to another, others are very culturally specific and target the most taboo or sensitive areas of life. Rebecca Roach is a lecturer in philosophy at the University of London and is currently writing a book about swearing. She wrote a piece for Eon called Naughty Words. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
How long do you think swearing has been around?
I think probably as long as we've been speaking. I mean, there's not reliable records for this, but certainly the practice of insulting people has been around for a very long time. And you can see examples of that in Shakespeare and the sort of uses of crude language to insult other people. So roughly what we mean today when we talk about swearing.
So you've looked at a lot of reasons why swearing might be powerful. One idea is that swearing often conveys anger, but is that always the case?
No, not at all. That's the way. That's one of the ways that swearing can be used to express emotion. But it also plays a big role, for example, in comedy. So it can be amusing for people to swear. It can also help us bond with other people. You know, if you sort of maybe out for a drink with some colleagues who you don't know very well, and then as the evening wears on, you relax, and when people sort of start to talk more informally and they might swear, and that could be a sort of signal that you know, the relationship has changed to something more informal. So it's a sort of, it's a way of giving off friendly social signals. It can also be threatening, or we can just use swear words in the way that we use other sorts of words. So we can use them as verbs or as nouns, or, you know, depending on what the word in question does. So it has a variety of uses, and expressing emotion is only one of them.
Well, and that's one of the things you just touched on that I think is really intriguing about swear words, is that they don't seem to be confined by grammar in the same way that other words are. So if we think of a favorite, or maybe I should say a common swear word, it can creatively be used as an adverb, an adjective, a noun, or a verb. Do you think there's a reason that swear words have developed in that way when other parts of our language maybe have not?
Yeah, so there's been some work done on this, especially by the linguist James McCauley, who's no longer with us. But he noted, he was writing about a particular swear word, the F word, and he noticed that it has two types of uses. One is just if you imagine it being a verb like any other, so you can use it to you can use it in much the same way you would use any other verb. When you're using it in that way, it behaves, it's quite well behaved linguistically. It behaves in a similar way to other verbs. But then there is also the sort of the other way that you would use it, the way that you use it to sort of insult people, or just as an exclamation. And it's then that it sort of takes on these strange properties, and it sort of becomes very versatile. It's perhaps to do with the role that it plays. So it's sometimes said that when we exclaim a swear word, that's a way of just letting off steam. That's kind of more like a scream than an utterance. So you're not necessarily trying to communicate something. You're just trying to give vent to emotion. So that's one possibility. I also think that it has something to do with the way that we're brought up. So, you know, if we're brought up as children, we're taught to use language in certain ways. We're told that you know, sort of we're corrected if we use the wrong word endings for verbs and so on, or if we make certain other grammatical mistakes. But obviously, that doesn't happen with swearing. We're just told we're not allowed to swear, and that's the only rule we're taught. You know, we don't help children swear correctly. We just tell them not to swear. So there is this sort of, I think, a sense of sort of, you know, once you've broken the rule not to swear, you can kind of do what you like. I mean, that's a sort of very simplistic way of doing it. But I certainly don't think we necessarily feel ourselves bound by linguistic rules when we swear in a similar way that we would do with the rest of language.
There are a lot of different types of swear words, but one of the elements that they seem to have in common often is that they invoke taboo subjects. What are some of those taboo topics that are most often used to create swear words?
Yeah, so swear words, the offensiveness of swear words tend to track what our most offensive taboos are. So, there are similarities between these across cultures and languages. So religious words play a big role in swearing. If you think of it in English, sort of religious-themed swear words have become a lot less powerful and less offensive over the last few decades. So if you think about the line from Gone with the Wind, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn," you know, that was really shocking when the film was released. But now, you know, that's really mild. There are sexual swear words, so they sort of became they sort of rose in their offensiveness in the sort of Victorian era. There are also sort of lavatorial types of words, obviously. And then there are some that sort of appear more often in some languages than in others. So there's what you might call sort of hierarchical terms, which involves expressing disrespect to usually to somebody's mother. Now, there's only sort of a couple of terms in English swearing that, that play that role. You can probably guess what they are. But there are a lot more of them in some other languages, like Spanish and Italian. In some cultures, like in Dutch, disease words are used as a sort of swearing insult. So you can call somebody a tuberculosis sufferer, and that will be a term of abuse. So there is a little bit of variation, but there are these sort of common themes, really, of religion, lavatorial terms, and sex. These sort of seem to be fairly consistent throughout languages and cultures.
I found it interesting that in your essay in Eon called Naughty Words, you also say that swear words tend to have a short, sharp sound to them, and that much more soft and longer words would have a hard time being taken seriously as a swear word. Why do you think the actual sound and kind of shape of those words kind of gives added emphasis to them being swear words?
Yeah, so it certainly seems to be the case that swear words do have that in common, that they are quite short and sharp. Some people have suggested that that is actually behind that's the reason that they're powerful, which I don't think is quite true. You know, we have lots of words that are short and sharp, but which are, aren't offensive. I think it simply has something to do with what we want swear words to do very often. So we want swear words to give us the power to express emotion. And making certain sounds just happens to be we find it more suited for that purpose, exactly the same way that we find certain body language more sort of satisfying as a way of expressing emotion. So if you're angry, you'll sort of maybe clench your fists, you'll tense up and so on, you'll talk in a louder voice. It would be sort of very difficult to express anger, sort of while relaxing, reclining on the sofa, talking, maybe whispering, and being perfectly relaxed. So I think that the sound that swear words make just sort of fit in with all of the other ways that we find to express emotions. It's just a kind of body language type thing.
It sounds like you're saying that they're almost a verbal form of a slap or a punch.
Yeah, they can be. I mean, that's a good way of putting it. We often use them like that. So one way of looking at swear words, actually, is that we can use them as an alternative to violence. So if two people are sort of having a shouting match and swearing at each other, and you might be thinking, oh, they're going to start hitting each other in a moment. But before it gets to that stage, you have swearing. So it's a way of being very aggressive, but without resorting to physical violence.
Rebecca Roach is a lecturer in philosophy at the University of London. She's currently writing a book about swearing. And Rebecca, it seems like a lot of the common characteristics that we've outlined, it explains some, but not all, of the power that swear words hold. So what is the importance of context, to whom we're speaking, when we're saying it, and how the words are said?
Well, context is hugely important. So you can say you can swear if you're sort of out with your friends in an informal setting, and nobody will bat an eyelid. But if you use the same language in a job interview, for example, or in a sort of formal work meeting, then everybody's likely to be shocked, even if they're the same people. So swearing is not merely sort of offensive always and everywhere. Its offensiveness depends on the context. And I think, when we're sort of looking for an explanation of why swearing is offensive, it's absolutely essential that we have to take into account the role of context, because, without the right context, swearing is not offensive at all.
Rebecca, as we wrap up, language is always evolving. Do you see swearing evolving in interesting ways?
Yeah, absolutely. So what's sometimes most offensive in among our swear words is always we're going to track what we find most offensive as a society. And there has been some sort of research done in this which shows that certain words, such as the F word, it sort of declined in offensiveness over the years. So this is the this is research that's been done just by sort of asking people how offensive they find certain words when they hear them on TV. So over sort of the course of a few decades, the F word becomes sort of a little less offensive than it once was. And on the other hand, racist and homophobic slurs have become more offensive. And that's, you know, I think, well, that's a good thing. That's sort of, we're less tolerant of racism and homophobia in our society. So if you think about sort of maybe a couple of decades ago, it's sort of been not unheard of for people just to sort of be casually racist in conversation. That's sort of frowned upon in many more contexts than it once was nowadays. So if you really want to be offensive, then you can be racist. But, of course, there's sort of independent reasons why that's a bad thing to do.
Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Roach is a lecturer in philosophy at the University of London and is currently writing a book about swearing. She wrote a piece for Eon called Naughty Words. Next, we'll break down the latest Kids Count data book released today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tomorrow after 4, we'll talk to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin. She'll explain why she thinks we should end the one-year ban on blood donations from gay and bisexual men. And she'll also weigh in on gun safety votes in the Senate as well. That's tomorrow after 4 on Central Time. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up today, the Kids Count data book came out. It ranks states on different factors of children's well-being. We'll talk to a guest from the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families about our state's ranking and the racial gap for children here. First, solar power and other renewable energy sources are making gains in Wisconsin, to the point where some advocates are saying the end of the line could be coming for monopoly electric utilities in the state. Others say big power companies are here, but that major changes may be in store. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Most people in Wisconsin still use electricity that comes from power plants running on coal, natural gas, or nuclear energy. But with dropping prices for solar energy panels the last few years, more folks are signing up to have solar arrays in their yard or on their house. Enough for at least curious that on Saturday at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair, a busload of people signed up for a tour of homes that have solar panels installed by the Stevens Point company, Northwind Renewable Energy.
This home here, if you look at your sheet that I had handed out for the cases.
Northwind design consultant Rob Peck stood outside the home of Jackson Case and described the solar panels, electricity converters, and other equipment that were put in last year. Case says he's very happy with the system, including the way on sunny days he can sell excess electricity back to the local utility, the Wisconsin Public Service Corporation.
How can I say it? Right now, public service owes us about $250. It's kind of cool, you know? And that, along with the solar thermal that we put on about 10, 12 years ago, and a wood stove inside, we have just absolutely come this close to being off the grid.
The desire to at least nearly get off the electrical grid, meaning disconnect from the local utility, seems to be part of the motivation of people who may spend tens of thousands of dollars on a solar power system. Becoming more independent from big power was a goal of Stevens Point solar homeowner Jan Roberts.
I don't like utility companies.
Ann Roberts says she really doesn't like that investor-owned utilities are raising some fixed rates for consumers and, she contends, making it tougher for more people to go solar.
I just wish that the policies of the utility companies encouraged solar systems.
Utilities argue they need to maintain the electrical grid and buy coal, natural gas, or uranium to supply power for the majority of Wisconsin residents. But some argue that majority could shrink very soon, and power companies will become more power managers than providers. John Farrell of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance told the Energy Fair during a keynote speech that a federal study has shown as much as 40% of electricity in Wisconsin could come from rooftop solar.
That's not counting parking lots where we could put solar, brownfields, landfills, solar anywhere else that you can think of.
The group Repower Madison has been pushing local utility MG&E to become more of a community partner and get more electricity from renewable sources. Repower's Mitch Bry says there's been some progress.
But they are not really as ambitious as we need to tackle these problems, and they lack really the specifics or the metrics to be considered a true plan.
But MG&E spokesperson Dana Bruick says the utility's Energy 2030 plan released last year continues the company's effort to reduce carbon dioxide emissions and increase renewables.
We consider it a very ambitious plan, and if we can go faster, we will.
Bruick says as more homeowners generate their own power with solar panels, that does make for more challenges in managing the electrical grid. But she hesitates on speculating whether the business model for utilities will change. She says technology and price changes may give power companies more generating options, too. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Today, the Annie E. Casey Foundation released the 2016 Kids Count Data Book. The report's an annual ranking of states on 16 key measures of child well-being, including educational, social, economic, and physical measures, looking back at 2015. For the third year in a row, Wisconsin ranks 13th in overall well-being for children. But the report found large disparities between children of color compared to white children nationally. Ken Taylor is with us to break down the latest Kids Count report. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, which helps gather state and local information for the Casey Foundation. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Judith.
So as we just mentioned, Wisconsin is ranked 13th nationwide on overall well-being of children, and that's been a position we've held for a while. Is that pretty good?
So that's pretty good. We're a top-tier state, so I think the exact number that we are, whether it's 11th or 13th or 14th, is less important than sort of a top-tier, middle-tier, or bottom-tier. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that we've been consistent in the top-tier, at the lower end of the top-tier, but in the top-tier, is good news, but it also masks some challenges that we have in our state.
Well, and often when we're looking at national data, it's not quite as useful to compare ourselves to all the other states, but to especially look at the region where we are. So how do we come out looking at other Midwestern states?
Well, the Midwest and the Northeast are the two parts of our country that have the highest levels of well-being. Just so happens that some of the top-ranked states are our neighbors. And so using this Rankin methodology, Minnesota is the number one state, and Iowa is the number three state. Hmm. And so so there are Midwestern states that are doing better than us, but overall, the Midwest does pretty well on average when you look across all kids. But again, in those states as well, there's challenges when you dig deeper into the data.
We mentioned in the introduction that the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families helps to collect this data. It seems like a huge amount of information for the Casey Foundation to collect and then make sense of. What are some of the other sources that the study is based on?
Well, every state has its own data sources, and so we put up a lot of data on the WCCF website that isn't part of this Kids Count data report. In order to make apples-to-apples comparisons, they need to look at data sources that are relatively consistent across all of the states. And so there's a lot more data available on our website than is available in this data book. And so we look at state agency data information and sometimes more local. But every state has a slightly different profile that they're able to put up on their own Kids Count data center. But these 16 indicators are in part chosen because they are consistently measured across so that you can make an apples-to-apples comparison between different states.
Well, let's dig down into some of the data specifically for Wisconsin. One of the big factors that's looked at is economic well-being for children. How are we doing on that one?
Well, our ranking there is about what our overall ranking is, but there's some very troubling trends in that data. And so the fact is that compared to the recession, the years of the recession, that poverty is actually continuing to get worse, even as we're theoretically rebounding from the recession. And so that's one of the things that we're very concerned about, because we know that the long-term negative impacts of kids growing up in poverty has long-term effects on their education and their ability to get family-supporting jobs themselves when they're in the workforce. And so we're very concerned about that. And what that means is that there's about 250,000 children in our state that live in families below the poverty line. And so in our state, that's just under 20%, but it's been getting worse over time. And when you look at that broken down both by race and by geography, we find out that it's not equally distributed across the state. So we have a lot of work there as well.
Mm-hmm. Earlier in the show, we actually talked about how new research is showing that poverty can actually be a cause of depression in adolescents. So there are many ripple effects.
Right. And we're learning more and more. Some of the groundbreaking research is being done here at the University of Wisconsin at Madison around brain development in young kids. And the stress that kids grow up under and what that means for how their brain develops over time is getting increasingly understood and is troubling. So when you look at the data and you break it out by race, you see that kids of color are substantially more likely to be poor than white kids. And here in Dane County, we see that as well. So we see a ratio of 10 to 1 when you look at the poverty of African-American kids, for example, compared to white kids. Over half of the African-American kids in Dane County are poor. More than half of the African-American kids across the state are poor. We also see nearly half of our Native American children and over a third of our Latino children and 1 in 5 Asian children are poor in our state. So we also know that geography matters. And so when we see the effects of the recession, we see a lot in our rural communities as well that are struggling to rebound.
We are talking with Ken Taylor right now. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. We're talking about the recently, today released, Kids Count data book from the Annie E. Casey Foundation that's looking at the well-being of children across the nation, and we're looking specifically at Wisconsin. So, Ken, as you were saying, because minority kids are a smaller number, their situation, their plight really is being masked in that data because the kids in white families are doing so much better.
Right, yeah. So if you look at averages, we tend to do quite well as a state. But when you break that down by different subgroups, we see that there's a wide variation. And we're seeing that across the country as well as our economic system is getting more divided and the income inequality is increasing, that we're seeing these wider gaps. And so that should be troubling for all of us because that we know the long-term implications of these gaps will harm all of us in the long run. And so it's really important that we come around collectively to address them as a society.
So I have to say, looking at education initially, my thought was, we're number 7. That's pretty good. And then I looked at some of the statistics that come under it, and I thought, whoa, there's some issues here.
There certainly is. And so I think we should be proud of certain things about our education system. And, the highlight of school high school graduation. So we're actually tied for the highest rate in the nation for a high school graduation in 4 years.
And what is that rate?
So it's 93%. So 7% of high school students don't graduate on time in our state. But again, as you rightly noted, that masks, some real significant disparities in that. And when we break it down by race, we see that we have some of the lower high school graduation mm-hmm. rates for kids of color, with the biggest gap with African American students in our state. And so again, it's important to highlight things that are good and emphasize things that we should be proud of, but also know that sometimes within that are areas of deep concern, and we need to take a good hard look at the negatives along with the positives.
We're talking with Ken Taylor from the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families about the latest Kids Count data book released today, and we're taking your calls as well at 800-642-1234. Why do you think there's such a gap between the well-being of children of color and that of white children in our state? What do you think needs to change to make Wisconsin a great place to live for all children? And what's the experience of your children or grandchildren in the Badger State? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Ken Taylor from the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, and we're talking about the latest Kids Count data book, which was released today. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Why do you think some kids are doing so much better than others? What do you think needs to change to help to close the racial gap for children in Wisconsin? And how would you like to see things change for young Wisconsinites? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we just talked about education, and actually David from Appleton is on the line with something to share, so let's go there. David, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I am a teacher, and I see that if the parents have achieved a college degree, then the children are more likely to do better in school because the parents make it a habit to, you know, to push them to study and do their homework, whereas parents that barely graduated or have no high school or didn't graduate, their children tend to be less, the education is less emphasized in their homes.
All right. Thanks for that call, David. And Ken, in your experience, how much are the patterns that are in place now going to play out in 20, 40 years down the road?
Well, we certainly do see sort of these multi-generational cycles that David was talking about, and we do know that some of those things perpetuate. We also know that it's related to income and the amount of time that parents are able to spend with their kids. So not only is it the education level, but it's we know how closely education level is related to income. Mm-hmm. And we know that when parents are working two jobs and are stressed and don't know where the rent's going to come from, their ability to support their kids' education will be more limited. And so it is education level, but that's also has a lot to do with income level.
So let's move on to children's health, because that's certainly a big issue as well. We come in at 29th. Is that a change over the last few reports?
So that has gone down, and mainly that's due not so much that our children's health has gotten worse, but other states are passing us by on many of these indicators. And so one of the things that we used to be a top-tier state in is around the number of our kids, the percent of our kids who are covered by health insurance. Mm-hmm. And so if we look 10 years ago, we were in the top five states in the country for that. Our rate of child insurance hasn't changed much, but a lot of states have passed us by, in part due to the changes that have happened at the national level with the Affordable Care Act, which has substantially increased the insurance of kids in many states that have taken advantage of the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. Our state hasn't taken advantage, and so many states have passed us by. So it's not so much a reflection of health is getting worse for our kids, but in these rankings, it's relative. And so it's really that on these measures, health is getting better for lots of other states.
And so moving forward, what would have to happen for Wisconsin to catch up to and keep pace with our neighbors?
Well, I think one of the things that we could do is take advantage of the Affordable Care Act, which does increase health insurance for everyone. And so that could substantially boost our capacity to on these health measures. And it would also allow us to invest in other things that support kids, because we're foregoing hundreds of millions of dollars a year in federal support for our healthcare system, which then means that we have that much less money to invest in education or job training or these other things. And so that would be a big step forward, both to affect these health indicators that you're talking about, but also other things that are important for kids and families.
Let's go back to the phones, and Ronnie in Oshkosh is up. Hi, Ronnie.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you have?
I'm here passing through y'all state, and I come up here periodically. But what he's talking about as far as children, okay, being miscounted for education goals, that's been going on for the longest. When they went from private to charter, that was just a sign to channel money somewhere into the private sector. So if you're taking money from one side of the spectrum and put it on the other side, you're going to deprive the other side, which is this Constitution say every child should get an education.
Thanks for that call, Ronnie. Running a little short on time, and want to make sure that we can respond to that. So Ronnie was really saying something similar to what you were, Ken, that, you know, when money is not being taken advantage of in one area or being used in one area, there's a ripple effect. There's a downstream effect.
It does. And shifting money from public schools, you know, creates a challenge for that system. And, you know, we have one of the longest histories of vouchers and charter schools in the country, and so there's a lot of strong feelings on all sides of that issue. And the data that I've seen has not shown that there is demonstrably better output or impacts on kids on the charter or private side. And so that then begs the question around about what that. The results that has on the public education.
So Ken, we've talked especially about a racial gap showing up in many of these different factors that are covered in the report. This is not a new issue. Do you see any progress on that, or are there some solutions out there that we have not tried yet that we really need to be looking at?
So there's good news and bad news, I would say, that in some ways things are getting worse, but in other ways I think things are getting better. And one of the ways that things are getting better is that we're talking about it more. So this was something that these racial inequities were sort of brushed under the rug if they were known at all. It wasn't something that you spoke about in polite company, so to speak. And that's changing. This conversation demonstrates that. And so that's an important first step, but we have to get beyond talk. We have to get to action. And so for us, we believe that we need to invest in a two-generation approach, which means making sure that families and parents have family-supporting jobs, increasing wages, increasing hours, and having more consistent work, and also high-quality education for kids. And you put those two things together, we have to have a sense of urgency, but we also have a long-term commitment. We didn't get into this position overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight, and we need to come together collectively over the long term to make it happen.
Ken, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Judith.
Ken Taylor is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. He joined us to talk about the latest Kids Count data book, which was just released today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.